radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome to the Leader's Toolbox on firehouse.com. I'm your host, Rich Gassaway, and today I'm with Fire Chief Rick Klein of the Plymouth, Minnesota Fire Department. Rick has been the chief in Plymouth, Minnesota for 16 years. He has a master's degree in public safety from St. Joseph University outside of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He is a graduate of the Executive Fire Officer Program, and he is a credentialed chief fire officer also from the Commission of Public Safety Excellence. Rick was a speaker at Fire Rescue International in Dallas, and he spoke on the topic of redefining our culture, avoiding your perfect storm. And I have him today as our guest. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you.
Rick, why do you believe that our fire service culture plays an influencing role in reducing line-of-duty deaths and firefighter injuries?
Well, I think over the years, Rich, we have struggled as a fire service to really identify what is killing at an unchanged rate of firefighters year in, year out in the American fire service. And I think I've come to the conclusion, and I'm certainly not the only one, I think, in the American fire service that has, that we need to take a very focused look at our culture, specifically the American fire service culture, and take a look at it through the lens of how does that impact and how does it influence behaviors that contribute to our line of duty deaths in our country. I think one of the things to recognize as a culture, and let me just perhaps back up just a second and talk about culture in general. A culture is when we talk about cultures, we're really talking about what defines us as individuals and as an organization. And we look at those behaviors, those beliefs, those norms that really go into identifying the behaviors and attitudes that we have, again, both as individuals and what we possess as organizations. And I think as the fire service, we've done a very, very good job of identifying technological fixes, if you will, to firefighter safety on the fire ground, both on and off the fire ground, but specifically towards the fire ground. So we've tried to, through policy procedure, through systems management, through technology and applications of how we fight fires tactically, what we fight fires with, our apparatus and appliances, they've been improved dramatically. However, what we continue to see year in, year out is no change in our line of duty deaths. We are still killing firefighters at a rate that we saw in the 1970s. So whether we change technology, we continue to kill at a rate that we've seen 30 years ago, despite a reduction in structural fires. So to many in the fire service, I think we look at it from a cultural viewpoint and looking at adaptive behaviors. There's learned behaviors that through our careers in the fire service, and I think even before we enter the fire service, the influence that society has on the expectations of the firefighter, the American firefighter, influences the behaviors that we have, particularly on the fire ground and also in driving and response. And I think that's where we need to go. That's the next step if we truly want to change and have a positive impact on changing the culture of the American fire service. It does not mean by any regard that we change perhaps some of our proud traditions that we continue to be very proud and honor. However, I think it does, for a lot of us who have been doing this a lot of years, it really points to the point of there's things that we have been doing for years and years and years that we need to change and still remain an aggressive fire service. But as I kind of coined the term, I think there's a level of smart aggressiveness that we need to begin to apply, which frankly, we don't.
I agree. Yeah, one of the things you had said, Rick, was, we've done a pretty good job of changing our systems and our technology. Some would say that's the low-hanging fruit. Even though it might be expensive to change systems and technology, that might be the easier thing to change because, technology, systems, apparatus, gear, SCBA is not a thinking being. It doesn't have culture. It's an innate object that can be engineered to improve our safety. So that's maybe been the easier part of creating this change. Is it fair to say the harder part is yet to come with trying to create change in a culture?
Yes, is the answer to your question. Changing a culture really means changing the behaviors of the individuals and of the organization. And those adaptive behaviors, that term I used before, those learned behaviors, which are reinforced generally through positive reinforcement in our fire service, is a very complex issue. And it's something that, in my estimation, will take a decade at a minimum, really to begin to see a positive change to a reduction in line of duty deaths on the fire ground. But I do believe there are things that we can do which are less invasive, if you will, on some of the some organizations that truly believe in it's either a culture of extinguishment, which was heard recently at one of the national conferences, versus a culture of safety. And I'm a believer that there can be a mend, that you can meet in the middle and utilize a smart, aggressive risk management approach and still be aggressive, still meet the expectations and be proud of the traditions of the American Fire Service and the culture of the American Fire Service. But these cultures take a long time to change, and it takes very consistent leadership and very committed leadership to do that. And we talk a little bit about that in the presentation on ways maybe to do that and to influence that and to introduce that those types of changes to that culture. But that commitment, the safety culture, there's a lot of definitions, and the aspect of looking towards a culture and how it influences the safety is really we get that from industry, primarily beginning in the 80s through a number of large-scale disasters. And we saw it in our country with the Challenger NASA example of organizational apathy and a cultural apathy towards safety. So when we talk about a culture of safety, really what I would define that as consistently safe behaviors that produce a product of group values and beliefs that affect that safety performance. And again, this is not going to be an overnight success, but I think there's little successes that you can have as a leader, as an organization, that will greatly impact and influence your road towards having that safety culture. And hopefully minimizing the risk to firefighters and reducing your exposure to a line of duty death, which is what we want to see. That's the end goal, is to reduce firefighter deaths.
Rick, listeners wouldn't know this, but a while back you and I had an opportunity to visit Northwest Airlines and talk to some of their safety personnel about how they do their safety programs. And we talked at one point in the discussion about the crew resource management philosophy and how it was introduced and instilled into the culture of the airline industry. And I remember specifically you asking the question, how long did that take to get that culture to change? And I remember he said, as you had reaffirmed here, it took 10 years. It seems like we've been 10 years trying. And I like to think we're planting seeds and roots are growing and We're making some inroads, but we're not quite where maybe the airline industry was after their 10 years of effort. So I think there's, as much as people would say, you know, they've heard enough about safety, let's get back to, you know, fighting the fires, I don't know that we're quite to where we should be in our perspective and our culture of safety. What do you
I agree with you, and I think there is a grassroots movement, and I think when you read some of the blogs that are out there and some of the comments that come back, it's encouraging to me to say, hey, that chief is speaking. I mean, he's speaking towards what we need to change here in our culture. Meaning, you know, we're looking at some of these line of duty deaths and people talking about those. And I truly believe that there is a grassroots movement, and it's coming from, I think, all levels of the fire service. I think there's an expectation of our younger members of us that we provide a safe workplace for them. I'm not sure that was the case decades ago. And I think it's being driven by some senior leadership who the coin, the nickel's finally dropping, said enough is enough. We need to do something. It's going to take a lot of hard work. I think you saw the airline industry, and that was fascinating going down to the airlines and see how they do their business and see the parallels between what they're doing and have done and what the fire service is doing and can do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you brought up crew resource management, and I think some aspects of crew resource management can be applied to the fire service now very easily, or perhaps not easily. That's not a good word way to look at it, perhaps, but can be applied by some innovative leadership to impact safety. When, you know, when we look at one of the fire service cultural norms of, you know, you're never going to question a superior officer as to an assignment or order, which traditionally, you know, if you give a firefighter an order, they're not going to question you. And that's culturally based. That's ingrained in that firefighter based on a number of things. And crew resource management says, hey, it's okay for the firefighter to say, hey, chief, I'll be happy to go in A side with this 1¾ inch, but did you know the whole C side is on fire and there's nothing, it's fully involved. Does it make sense to do that? And I think that's a good message to send. The sender needs to be to know that they can do that, and then the receiver needs to say, hey, it's okay. They have to have the ego and drop that ego and say, hey, the kid's right. I didn't do a proper scene assessment kind of thing. So it will take time. And I think there's some things, though, that we can do. We identify some areas of change, and then I think we gradually begin to pick away at them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you saw it with the airline industry. You know, mm-hmm. One of the things, and you mentioned, you know, when you get in on an airplane, your expectation or the pilot's expectation is they're going to fly you from point A to point B, and they're going to walk home or get on the next flight, fly back to their family. You know, one of the cultural impediments in the American Fire Service is that's not the case. The American Fire Service, a number of people believe it's okay, it's an obligation perhaps, to risk your life and die in the line of duty, where in no other industry is the culture indicate that. So we have, and if you look at just from that viewpoint, we have an uphill battle of overcoming that attitude and that behavior. And the airline didn't have to battle that. They had to battle other issues in cockpit management. But there's some unique industry issues, cultural issues, to the American Fire Service that can be identified that really negatively impact, you know, how quickly I think we can get there, because there's long-term change that has to happen. And it's not okay to die in the line of duty. For a lot of firefighters are going to die. It's a risky business. But the vast majority of deaths out there are avoidable.
A couple points to add on to what you said. I was delivering a program on decision making and situation awareness, and I made it a point of discussing crew resource management and how it came from the airline industry and has been adopted for the fire service. And I think that I tried to rack my brain, but I think that crew resource management in the concept for the fire service has probably been around, the early teachings of it maybe 10 years ago. I can remember attending a program at, might have been Firehouse Expo, and Dennis Rubin, who was then in Dothan, Alabama, as the fire chief, talked about crew resource management, and it was a fairly new concept for the fire service, but that's been 10 years ago. I'm teaching this program, and in the class is a commercial airline pilot, and he comes up to me on break and says, I really wish this crew resource management thing that we do in aviation would take hold in the fire service. You know, that this training would come into the fire service. And I thought to myself, well, it has. At least it's tried to. You know, seeds have been stuck in the ground. But here's a pilot, commercial pilot, firefighter, who I think maybe for the most part wasn't aware that crew resource management is something that has transitioned its way into the fire service. So we certainly have some work to do in continuing to carry our message, especially about crew resource management. And you had said about the firefighter who can disagree with the superior. It reminded me of another scenario where I was doing a program for a large metropolitan department, over 100 people in the room, all from the same department. And I was talking the very same thing that you were about, the ability of a firefighter to point out something to a superior that could save someone's life if the order was flawed because of the superior missing the opportunity to see something or to comprehend something. And this firefighter in the room raised his hand, angrily said to me, I completely disagree with you. It is my job as a firefighter to follow the orders of my superior officer without question at all times, always, and in all ways. And I don't know if he was trying to impress his bosses who were in the room or if he really felt that. He certainly said it with enough compassion that I thought that he felt that if his superior told him to do something, that even if he thought it would result in his own injury or death, he would not question the order, but would do it without question. And it certainly follows, you know, a military model, a military mindset. But we've learned through aviation with this crew resource management that one person can't see it all. And that firefighter who brings that information to the superior's attention isn't being insubordinate, but sharing information that might save a bunch of people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think the hurdle for the fire service is this, is that I'm hesitant to adopt any program all at once. In other words, we took crew resource management from aviation, we said we plopped it down in the fire service and expect it to work. And I'm hesitant to do that because though there's parallels, there's also differences. And the diversity of the American Fire Service doesn't always lend itself to a packaged program. And I think there's aspects of crew resource management that really make sense for the fire service to adopt. Some are perhaps more quickly adapted and adopted by the fire service. But there's others that are perhaps second tier. And I think we need to look at that whole crew resource management. You mentioned communications. That's part of crew resource management. And look at that and see what parts of that really make sense for the fire service and push the envelope as far as safety goes. I think there's a lot of good stuff out there. It's a matter, I truly believe, in leaders leading. Mm-hmm. And seeing the need to do this.
Another thing that you had mentioned, Rick, that I just want to put a plug in for was you talked about the duty to die syndrome. This theory, philosophy, was first advanced, at least as I know it, in the fire service setting by Brian Crawford, the fire chief, mm-hmm. now in Shreveport, Louisiana, who wrote a position paper on this in a national publication and has since had many opportunities to speak on this topic at conferences. And I've heard Brian speak, and he's a close associate of mine, but I think he has touched on a very sensitive issue. I think there are people in the room that when he is speaking to the topic of this duty to die, that some adamantly disagree that we shouldn't be out there laying our life on the line all the time, and sometimes miss, I think, the point that Brian's trying to make is that somehow in the fire service there are some people who think that fame and glory come to them as the result of dying in an incident. You and I were talking offline, and you'd shared with me about an associate that you had once had a conversation with who said to you that if and when the day would come that he would die, he would wish that it would be in a fire. And, you know, that kind of put an exclamation point on this whole, you know, duty to die and, dying with honor. And it's pretty scary when you think about if there are people out on the incident scene who are operating under this philosophy of the duty to die. What, Rick, what internal and external influences impact how we define our culture?
Well, I think that our culture is really defined by, and you look at culture, I think you have the organizational culture, and you have the American Fire Service culture. And I think truly you have the culture, if you will, to a smaller degree of the platoon you work with or the volunteer company you work, you know, that select group of people you work with. I think we're influenced in a number of ways. I think predominantly one of the biggest influencing factors that we have really is what the societal image has of the American Fire Service. And though I think that image is a very positive one, it's one that we in the fire service should be very proud of. We earned that, the title of kind of, you know, America's hero, but what we do is we internalize the expectations that Mrs. Smith has of us. And what I mean by that is that when you look at popular media, if you look at Backdraft, if you look at... Excuse me. To edit that out.
Sure. Pause and edit.
When you look at... Give me an example here. When you look at... popular media, that how Hollywood depicts and categorizes and places the firefighter on a pedestal. Look at, you don't have to look any farther than any of the movies we have. Ladder 49, Backdraft, even going back to the days when it influenced me enjoying the fire service, Emergency. And when you look at how those media images portray the American Fire Service in a very positive light, we internalize that expectation. When you see Kurt Russell coming out of the building fire with his turnout coat undone and his boots down and his helmet cocked off to the side carrying a kid, you know, we know that doesn't work. Unfortunately, Mrs. Smith thinks that's what we're going to do. We're going to put out 110% every time we go to help her to be able to do that. Well, the reality of the situation is that, you know, chemistry and physics of fire don't lend itself to us walking around in fires like that, human beings walking around in fires like that. But we internalize that expectation that our customers have of us. And for us, it's very difficult to let go because when we bring the big red shiny fire truck to the scene, there's an expectation from Mrs. Smith that we're going to do something positively to influence that event. And we do. Unfortunately, we try to do the same thing that we see the actors doing in these movies. And we throw out the door any risk management. We throw out the door any of the principles of risk a lot, save a lot to try to satisfy these expectations. When you look, I'll give you another, maybe an internal example. When you look at how we introduce and indoctrinate our rookies into the fire service, you know, you look at the new person comes in the door and they're a sponge. And who do we put them with? We put them with a salty senior person who knows the trucks, knows the apparatus, and says, "Here, kid, here's what the manual says, but here's what really happens in the field. And here's, though we're supposed to manage risk, don't worry about it. I'm with you 100%. We're always going in to knock this fire down." And there's times that's appropriate, and there's times that's inappropriate. So we internalize that, and what happens to us in group behavior is that we as that young firefighter don't want to go against the expectations of the group, the norms and the beliefs of the organization, that we're an aggressive firefighting internal. And I've never, when I've talked to fire departments, categorize your department. Well, we're a highly aggressive interior attack company. Okay. What does that tell that new person coming in? When you look on the web and you see a lot of the fire departments portraying themselves in this over-aggressive manner, and the lyrics and the music that accompanies that, again, plays into how the individual internalizes the expectation of the organization. Okay, and you know, the people of the organization, the leadership of the organization, are going to set the tone for what they believe should and shouldn't happen. If they allow those behaviors to continue, especially if they're reinforced behaviors, and you see it, departments that or with a lot of near misses, but they continue to reinforce some of these behaviors that are over-aggressive behaviors, that just continues that momentum of, this is the correct way to act on the fire ground. So, to undo that, or at least to balance the level of that playing field, is going to be very difficult. But there are some good examples out there of organizations that are doing that, and leaders that are really challenging the status quo of how we've always operated, and bringing risk management into the equation.
I had taught a class where we were talking about risk management, and the fact that sometimes when you arrive, even though there's someone inside the building, it could be an unsavable life. You know, you have to do this assessment and say, am I going to take the appropriate amount of risk to save a savable life? And you have to do an assessment. You know, if you're looking at a building that has floor to ceiling, heavy, thick black smoke with flames mingled among it, you have to think, well, the floor temperature is, 300 or 400 degrees. Is there a savable life inside that building when skin melts at 160 degrees? And that's a judgment call to be made by the commander or the company officer on the first end, and I'm not here to tell you when and how to do that. But as I was talking about this and the group went on break, one of the people said to another person on break, he didn't say it to me, but he said it to another person on break, who then turned around and later told me, was, he said, I heard what he said, but I would never not go in. He said, anytime there's somebody inside, no matter how bad the conditions, I'm going in to try to save them. And the person who was telling this to me was a firefighter. And the person who was telling this firefighter this was his officer. And this firefighter was telling me how nervous it made him to think that his officer would not conduct some kind of assessment before he himself and or ordered his company to go in to in an environment that would be untenable to try to save an unsavable life because his whatever reason, ego or macho, or that's what I've trained to do, and by God, hell or high water, that's what I'm going to do. But he definitely had this cultural thing going that he would never, at least that's what he was saying, what he would do in the real world, I don't know. But he would never not go in, is the message that he was carrying to this firefighter, and unfortunately carried this message in the presence of other young firefighters who then...
Impressionable.
Right, yeah.
I mentioned, when you put this new person who comes in the door, who knows nothing about the fire service except what they've seen on television or seen in the movies, unless they've had a relative in the fire service, they're coming in, they're sponges, as I mentioned, and you're putting with someone, and not always the case, and which goes to the case of you really need to have a good mentoring program of people who are going to send the right message. It's a whole other discussion, but when you put them with a lot of the senior people who we tend to put our young people with, you hit it right on the head. What the messages are sending is safety's out the door, and the impressionable person is going to soak this in and not take into the consideration all of the other risks that are involved in fighting that interior fire attack, because this is the way we do it in this organization, and because this is the way it's always been done. You know, we're using tactics that were developed in 1890 still, which amazes me. And I'm not saying they're wrong, because in a lot of applications they're still very good, but there's tactics that we learned in the 1880s that have been carried through tradition that, frankly, I doubt there's anybody out there who can remember why we do them. You know, and that's kind of an organizational behavior thing. You know, Cornell did an interesting study a number of years back on the monkey see, monkey do. It reinforced the concept of we continue to project behaviors even after we've forgotten why we're doing it. So, kind of interesting on the old salts out there.
Mm-hmm. This is the Leader's Toolbox, firehouse.com. I'm your host, Rich Gassway. We're with Rick Klein talking about redefining our culture, avoiding the fire service perfect storm. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back in just a few minutes to continue this discussion of this fascinating topic that impacts firefighter safety.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Leader's Toolbox on firehouse.com. I'm your host, Rich Gassaway, and I'm with Rick Klein, the fire chief of Plymouth, Minnesota. In the introduction at the beginning of the podcast show, I forgot to mention to the listeners that Rick is also a senior associate in my consulting group, Gassaway Consulting Group, and travels around the country presenting on topics related to firefighter safety and leadership. And this podcast was actually inspired by a program that Rick had presented at Fire Rescue International in Dallas. So again, continuing our topic on redefining our culture, avoiding your perfect storm. Rick, I've heard you mention that leaders set the tone for what level of safety they'll tolerate. What does this mean? Explain this some more.
Well, leaders, you know, set the tone. What I mean by setting the tone is they establish expectations. They establish the rules, the policies, and when things, you know, get done. So setting the tone of the organization in the sense of the culture is that they're going to establish what they feel is acceptable and not acceptable as far as safety. So if they view safety as a secondary element to their fire service suppression group, then the concept of operating safely on the fire ground is not going to be part of that organizational culture. They are going to be completely, again, going back to that culture of extinguishment or culture of safety. Again, I believe there can be a blend. They're going to be on the balance arm of it's extinguishment all the time, 100% of the time, whether we should go in there or not. The behavior, you know, frankly, the behavior of the individuals is going to depend greatly on the behavior that is encouraged by the leadership. And that's what I mean by setting the tone, is that if leadership expects to operate a safe fire ground, then they need to get out there and lead by example and set the policy procedure, be accountable, set the direction of the department on what they believe to be a safe fire ground, and hold people accountable for their actions. And if aggressive driving in the fire service, which is one of our cultural impediments, is accepted by that leadership, then we can continue to expect firefighters and civilians dying in vehicle accidents, very often caused by us. But if the leader accepts that as part of doing the business, as aggressive driving, as the response time defense, then again, we can expect to see no change in our driving deaths. And we haven't, unfortunately, seen any change in our driving deaths over the years. So, you know, the example they set, both by what they do and what they say and what they follow through in, is very, very important for setting the tone, the safety tone of that department. And most chiefs, frankly, aren't willing to go down the road of saying, by the way, before you go in that front door, we're going to do a risk assessment on this. And I'm not taking a risk assessment that it's a pen and paper 5-minute deal, but it's something that you do, that your tactics and strategy are based on a cognitive thought, that you thought this out instead of reacting. And we tend to react more in the fire service than we really tend to think. But that goes back to setting the tone. And there's a recent chief, and I think in Texas, who said, before we go into any structural fire attack, we're going to do a risk management assessment. And that didn't go over very easy there because, it was against their culture. It's, this the reactive mode of always going and running into that particular structure fire. So that chief in this case is setting the tone for what they accept and what they don't accept. And, hopefully that chief will be able to manage this successfully in that department. But that's a big step culturally for the fire service and for that individual department, for somebody to come and say, hey, time out. Our lives are worth something here, and we're going to assess the risk before we put our lives on the line. And I think that that's correct.
I followed and read as that played out what was happening there in Texas, where the chief was saying, assess the viability of savable lives and structures before you go in so that we're not taking undue risks. And the firefighters' response was, we're supposed to take those undue risks. And I may be paraphrasing, and I'm sorry to the involved players if I am, but essentially they were saying, we're not going to waste time doing that. We're just going to go in and put the fire out or do the rescue without consideration for the size up that is part of figuring out whether that is viable. I when I read about that, I had this envision in my mind of a battlefield, and a company of soldiers are told to climb up this hill, go over the top, and kill the enemy on the other side. Well, if your company of soldiers go up to the top of the hill and you look over the other side and you see there's 20, 30, maybe 40 of the enemy, maybe you devise a plan and you try to outflank them and kill them off. But if you climb up that hill and you look over and there's 5 tank battalions and 400 soldiers and heavy artillery, are you going to still go screaming over the hill down the other side and shooting your gun and go out in a blaze of glory? Because you're going to lose. There's no way that you're outgunned. And at some point, at certain fires, you're outgunned. You're not going to be able to get ahead of it. As much as you want to, as much as you're trained to, there are times when the fire is going to exceed our abilities, and that's part of what you're talking about is conducting that risk assessment. What would you suggest? I said it's about the leadership, and I think that sometimes in organizations, the easy thing to do is to blame the leader. We don't do this because our chief does this, or we don't do that because he doesn't believe in this, or say you have an organization where the chief is not necessarily warmed up to the idea about a safety culture, but maybe some of the firefighters are. The lower ranks are like, we get it, but they can't convince the upper ranks to get it, to see it, and to embrace it. Any advice for those in the lower ranks who maybe do get it? It's kind of like the opposite of the Texas thing. You were saying where the upper ranks got it and the lower didn't embrace it. What about the opposite, where the line firefighters, company officers are kind of plugged in and saying this makes a lot of sense, but they haven't quite been able to get it to take traction in the any administrative offices.
Yeah, and I think you'll probably see that play out more and more in the fire services as the fire service ages, because like in general society, most of us who've been in the fire service for 30 plus years aren't going to be around much longer. And it's the younger people, I think the newer generations, that see, and as I mentioned early on, I think workplace safety is important to them, where perhaps it wasn't so much or so much of a consideration for us when we entered the fire service in the 80s. So with that said, I think you talk to not only the organizational culture from the safety aspect, but also from the organizational culture and how it's managed and led. And I think that all melds very, very closely to change. And my advice for the young firefighter who gets it, in your language, is to do perhaps the same things that I would encourage the leader who gets it. I mean, the chief who gets it. Number one is, remember that there's always a proper form. And the proper form is one of it's not tailboard chatter. It's one of, well, let's have a strategic plan and involve and be innovative about how we go about this. One of the things the young firefighter can do is do his or her homework and find out what some industry standards are, find out what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, and other, what are other organizations doing? What's the fire service, what are some of the pundits in the fire service feel about this? Choose the right pundit, perhaps, but, go out there and do your homework. I think, you're innovative as far as incorporating the lending ear of your company officers. I believe very, very great, strongly that there's really two levels of leadership in the fire service that have the most influence and impact. One is the chief fire officer, the fire chief, and the other is the company officer, because they can influence to a large degree what happens at that company level. But particularly how they influence and impact the younger firefighters who are under them. And you had an example earlier about the old salt and the young firefighter in the class that you gave of, I'm going to follow the orders 100% of the time of this person because I trust him so much. He has such a reputation. He's a hero in our – well, so, choose your allies. But I think there's a lot of company officers that would give you that lending ear and say, hey, that's not a bad idea. Why are we doing this? And even though we've always done it, is it time to change based on safety or based on a good change reason? And so be innovative in how you do that. And I think if that head of the organization is approachable and they're open, I know I would welcome that kind of feedback because my firefighters on the line are there every day, day in, day out. They see it oftentimes sooner before I will. So that feedback is very, very important. So having that communication and having those collaborative efforts, I think, will go a long way. Is it going to occur overnight? Probably not. But there's change that we've seen here in my department that's taken time. And I think when you get allies on board and you have the right forum, in other words, everything's above board and it's a level playing field, you gain the credibility that way as a firefighter, as a company officer, as any leader within the organization. And that credibility, which goes with respect, will get you that needed change. But then again, it may not be overnight. Again, you might be battling a culture that's done X for, we have some departments in the country that have proud traditions of close to 250 years probably out there. And that's going to take some time of convincing and just massaging and moving and taking small bits of the pie and having small successes.
You had spoken to the need to have the right forum and to make sure that you handle yourself with respect and professionalism toward your bosses. As I have traveled around and spoke with people about firefighter safety, I have heard in a number of occasions where firefighters or company officers have said to me, we've battled the administration about making change. And I think to myself, you're using defensive terms already. You know, you're battling. You know, that's not a very cooperative, collaborative, professional, courteous demeanor when you're talking about making change. You know, it's almost like we're going to be warring to try to make change versus saying, you know, let's find common ground. Let's find, you know, you think about that song, I think it's Breakfast at Tiffany's or something like that, and you know, they said, well, you know, we both like the breakfast. Okay, well, there's common ground. You know, not a big deal, not an important thing, but, you know, let's start there. We both enjoyed the meal we had. You know, find some common ground. Find a small victory, small ways to find ways to agree instead of this battle, this fight that incessantly will not result in a win-win. And that's really what you're looking for when you're trying to change a safety culture, is find a win-win. You know, I had once had a chief tell me that he was trying to change the safety culture of his organization, and the firefighters were battling this chief as he was trying to make the changes, and the conversation turned to the fact that the firefighters didn't like him very much for what he was trying to accomplish. And this chief said, and it's always stuck with me, and it's been many, many years ago that he said it. He said, you know, I'm not in a popularity contest. Those firefighters can hate me for the balance of their long and healthy lives, and I will consider that a success, because they will have lived so long to hate me for so long, mm-hmm. and I will consider that my success.
You're exactly right. And, you know, to me, one of the mantras, or one of the guiding principles of leadership, is you want to be a respected leader. And if you want to be popular and friends, that's nice. And I'm not saying you can't be a popular and respected chief, but you have to decide what type of leader you want to be. And leadership, Rich, you know as well as I do, that it's not always popular.
Oh, no kidding.
But I think you make a good point. You know, I think to have meaningful, lasting change, you need to find common ground. And you need to, in the case of the young firefighter who sees a need for change as far as the safety culture, you know, find that common ground and be willing to negotiate. Be willing to say, okay, that makes sense. You know, maybe that's part A of the equation, and then we'll continue to assess when we get to part B. So be willing to be flexible and adaptable, I think, to that.
Okay. Rick, could you give or offer some examples of leadership initiatives that maybe have resulted and reducing the risk potential to firefighters?
Well, I can give you some, and because I can give you some from our organization. And I'm not saying that these are, we're at the pinnacle of a safety culture, of course, we're far from it, but at least we in this particular department, my particular department, and it's not just myself driving, and I have a number of firefighters of all levels in the department who believe very strongly in safety. And there's some things that we've come up with that I think point to some successes and go to addressing some of the cultural impediments that the fire service culture has had on us. And I can give you one towards response in driving, and is that at one point in time, our department used to reward apparatus and other stations if they were first in on somebody else's district call. So what that reinforced was over-aggressive driving. Well, we recognized that after a couple years of near misses, and said, hey, this program, you know, the light bulb finally came on or the coin finally dropped. And to some of you, it may say, well, what took you so long? But the end note is that we recognized the need to change based on over-aggressive driving. And you know, we had an event in the United States a couple months ago, again in Texas, where there was over-aggressive driving, and essentially the departments were, the companies were doing the same thing, trying to be first in. One of the things that led to, and where I'm going with this, is a response matrix that we've developed, which provides our officers guidelines on how they will respond to various types of calls. And what we did, we took an historical analysis of a number of call event types, and based upon that in our experience, went and said, well, for this type of call event, this is a routine response. In other words, no lights, no siren. For this kind of event, the first truck goes red lights and siren, the balance of the response goes routine. So we developed a matrix that identifies that. Now, the company officer certainly has a discretion to alter that based upon the information they're getting and based upon, in some cases, the type of occupancy. So not all fire alarms, for example, are responded red lights and siren or routine. It really depends on the type of occupancy and some of the information we get back. The other partner with that, which is kind of, I think, part of this whole example, is that we collaborated with the dispatch agency, and when we look at fire alarms, they constitute 60% of our response volume. Our dispatchers now call into the occupancy and inquires if there's a problem as we're being dispatched. So that helps us determine the type of response. So it's very, very rare, frankly, that we end up responding from the station to the event, red lights and siren. Now, obviously, structure fires, rescue events, EMS events, they're different. But the vast majority of our smells and bells are routine in nature. And as I think the audience would agree with, you reduce your risk exponentially when you're not red lights and siren. You know, that speed factor goes away, the culture of response time goes away, the culture of we have to get there first goes away. So I think that's an example of response matrix, and we certainly aren't the only nor the first department to do that. But that was a big change, and that took time to, you know, we got the right people on board from the right all the levels in the department, and demonstrated the need, said here's where we want to go, here's why we need to go this direction. And for those that join the fire service because it's exciting to get on the 20-ton fire truck and go red lights and siren, well, to me, that cultural shift needs to occur. And yes, there's times where it's appropriate, but frankly, most of the time, it's probably not. So I think there's ways to begin taking little notches out of some of these negative impediments, these impediments that the culture, our culture, has we define our behaviors by.
I'm going to put you on the spot here, Rick. We hadn't had this discussion before. Can we have a copy of that risk matrix to put onto the bottom of the player page that the listeners could see an example that they could then maybe fashion something for their own organization? Thank you. And I'll make sure that we include a link to that on the bottom of the player page, because that's a good idea as one example, as an initiative that can help reduce risk for firefighters. Rick, what tools can leaders employ that could begin to bring about the change in the culture of safety?
Well, I think it needs to be gradual, Rich, but there are some things that that if you want to create a high performance organization, I think there's a couple ways to do that, and then maybe we'll go more directly to your answering your question. You know, there's a couple ways I think to change a process to change organizations. One is through continuous improvement, and you and I had spoken before we began today about continuous improvement and how that philosophy really can play in a positive fashion for the leader. And really, a continuous improvement is that you continually look at your processes in organization's case and see what can be tweaked. And certainly, if things don't need to be changed, you don't. But my guess is in most organizations, we're not static. We're dynamic. We're always changing. And there's things that we should be looking at. So it's continually assessing your organization for a high-performance organization. And you can say the same thing for culture. Are there things that you can change as far as safety to impact your firefighter risk reduction? Another strategy is a targeted intervention. If you use this strategy, you know, you're choosing one particular area within your organization to really focus upon. So if you want to focus upon all of your responders wearing seatbelts, well, okay, let's target that and find out perhaps what's the percentage of people that are using seatbelts. And this is one thing we did in our department is we found a fairly large number of people using seatbelts, but the difficulty that we found in this targeted research or intervention was that when they were going to a critical event is when seatbelts often weren't being used. So we altered some of our policies to reflect that. But that's an example of a targeted intervention where target seatbelt use, which is a big one in the fire service, and the manufacturers are getting better about incorporating seatbelt use into the seats in the BAs. And one of the things that we've done is we've given the firefighter the option of not putting their BA on in the truck. It's okay to get out of the truck with it on without your BA on and then get it on, because it's more important for me to have them in their tent gear and belted and then going to the scene for stressing in the truck as it's going to the scene, which my guess is a lot of departments continue to do. So we gave the option to the firefighter that I want you in the seat, I want you belted. We'll get going, and if you need to get your pack on there, that's okay. But that's an example of a targeted intervention. A transformational program is something which I'm not sure would work as far as a culture goes, but that's looking at the entire organization and then having a very, very quick and immediate and sustaining, or trying to have a sustaining change. Oftentimes it's not, because it's just you're trying to bite off too much of the pie, or cut too much of the pie away. And again, as I've said, in my opinion, your best approaches are just taking a philosophy of continuous improvement, continuing to assess your organization, and then, you know, have targeted interventions. If it's vehicle backing, if it's seatbelt use, if it's kind of a risk assessment and using the IAFC rules of engagement, incorporating those. There's some, I think, organizational change models you can use. As far as leadership, I really think it goes down to the leader being a leader, being innovative, integrating that safety message at all opportunities into the department. Departments that don't talk about safety at all are most likely at a higher risk than those that safety is on the forefront and that people are reminded about safety and it's okay to talk about. They're innovative. They innovated into their programming and how they approach training, how they approach firegrounds. And they're collaborative in their efforts, not trying to do it alone, the chief not pushing it down. It's two-way. You're using all levels of the organization to change, to get buy-in, to get input, and really, again, have that sustainable change that's going to be generational. And that's what really, when you look at a culture, that's what we're after, is that when my granddaughter enters the fire service, that it'll be a safer fire service based on a culture than where we are now. So 20 years from now, I'm hoping when she joins the fire service that it'll be a safer, but it's going to take time. It'll be a generational change. But the current leadership within the organization at all levels really needs to do the big time out and say, hey, enough is enough. These post-mortem rituals are nice and they're traditional, but we need to have far less of those than we have in the past.
Well, you talk about the need to make change and it taking time, and it's generational. I'm going to close with a story that was shared with me about Coach John Wooden, the very successful coach at UCLA. And UCLA's program, as the story was told to me, and listeners can confirm or refute it. I was too young to know what was going on at the time, but as the story is conveyed to me, the UCLA's program was basketball program was suffering, and they went to look for a new head coach, and they found this guy who had had some success, and they lured him to UCLA because he'd been such a successful coach, and that was John Wooden. And in the first season, as the story goes, they had a losing season, and so they overlooked it because he was a new coach. And then in the second season, He either had a losing season or kind of like a break-even season, and they kind of overlooked it. And then in the third season, he had only a marginally successful season. Maybe they, you know, ended up winning a few more games than they had lost for the year. And they started to question and doubt whether they had chosen the right person to be the coach of their program. And then the next year, they had a winning season. And then for the next 7 years consecutively, they won national championships. And as the story is relayed to me, somebody was interviewing Coach Wooden and said, you know, when you became the coach, the first year you had a horrible season, the second year you had a not-so-good season, the third year you kind of had a break-even, and the fourth year you had just a slightly successful season, and then seven consecutive national championships. What do you attribute that success to? And John Wooden, as it was reported, said, graduation. In other words, he had to build the culture of an organization from scratch, and he had to wait until some of the people who were there graduated and moved on. He couldn't change who they were as much as he had his philosophy and the culture that he wanted to have in the organization. He had to wait for graduation. And in some cases, sadly as it is, we're going to have to wait for graduation. We're going to have to wait for some turnover either in administrations or turnover in the firefighter ranks so that we're not carrying on traditions of risky behaviors that are passed down, this duty to die syndrome that we talked about earlier, passed down generation to generation, and get people who actually look at it as a fresh perspective. I know it's capable because back when I was a new firefighter, and you were a new firefighter, Rick, anybody that wore an SCBA was ridiculed and criticized and called a wimp, and you know, real firefighters don't do that. And now everybody wears an SCBA. It's not disputed. It's not debated. And there's no name calling when you wear your SCBA. In fact, you're ridiculed when you don't wear your SCBA. So that's an example of a cultural change. But it took a generation or better to get that in place. So I know that it's possible.
And it is. There's. You know, the fire service has a number of very proud and honorable traditions and cultural practices and beliefs that we should continue through the generations. But there's a number of other ones, and you mentioned, you know, one there where, it's going to take time to change. But we need to begin questioning, in my opinion, some of the ways we operate. You mentioned the SCBA use. You know, we talked about, our tactics at structural fires hasn't changed in probably 200 years, although our environment has. You know, so we need to adapt to our environment. And there's ways to do that and still be very proud cultural fire service. And I truly believe that we can still be aggressive and still do what Mrs. Smith wants us to do, but maybe it means tweaking the way we do things so that we operate safely, so that we're not the ones in the bright red fire trucks bringing the fatalities to the scene. Mm-hmm. And that, unfortunately, is generally what happens a lot of times. So I think we can change, but I think it just takes people to push back and just say, enough's enough. We need to change some of the practices that we've been doing for over 250 years.
Well, thank you, Rick, for sharing with me your perspectives on redefining the culture. At the bottom of the player page is a place to click to put your comments. I'd love to hear back from listeners about what they think about the fire service culture. Is it changing? Isn't it changing? Is it changing fast enough? Not fast enough? Are we focusing on the right things? Too much emphasis on safety? Not enough emphasis on safety? I'd love to hear your comments and get some debate going in the comments section on the bottom of the player page. So click on and share your thoughts and views, and we can all learn from each other as we share these different perspectives. Rick, thanks for giving the gift of your time to the Leaders Toolbox today. I really enjoyed having you as a guest.
Thank you, Rich, for the opportunity.
This is the Leaders Toolbox on Firehouse.com. If you have feedback or a question you'd like to address on the show, you can send that question to podcasts@firehouse.com. That's podcasts@firehouse.com. Thank you for listening.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to Firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.